I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is T. Jefferson Parker, author of 27 novels. His most recent is A Thousand Steps. Jeff and I talked about the intersection of fact and fiction, point of view and tense, and the hardest part of writing a novel. I hope you enjoy my talk with Jeff as much as I did. So, Jeff, I was trying to figure out how many times I've talked to you about your books. You have what, about 24 or more novels?
Yeah, this is my 27th novel, believe it or not.
Oh my gosh, okay.
I know.
So I've probably talked to you almost that many times about the different books. That's really interesting. I don't know if certainly there aren't any other writers that I've done that with, so I must like your stuff an awful lot.
I think that kind of proves it, you know?
So I'm so curious about A Thousand Steps. It's a departure from the Roland Ford novels. I think there were four. Mm-hmm. Were there four?
That's right.
Talk about what motivated this book.
You know, it kind of came out of nowhere at me. I just kind of fell in love with the idea of going back in time, specifically to 1968, when I was a 14-year-old boy discovering Laguna Beach for the first time. And I just could not resist writing this book. This book came, you know, reared up and bit me, and I couldn't let go of it until it was done.
I remember you talking about it the last time we talked about the last Roland Ford novel, and I remember you brought this one up, that you were working on it. I think you brought it up anyway. Mm-hmm. At some point in talking, I remember you bringing up this book, and there was a certain excitement in your voice about this material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have been very excited about this from the beginning. You know, some books kind of just grab you that way. You know, they write themselves. They're joyful to work on, and they just give you so much pleasure and so much excitement. Other novels are laborious, you know. They're very difficult to write, and it takes you forever to, you know, to figure out what story you're trying to tell, and then telling it seems to be, you know, kind of long and grueling sometimes. And this was just one of those gimme books that felt right and from the very start. And I thought from the concept of the story, you know, right down to the title, that there was a little bit of, I don't know, pixie dust or something on this book that makes it kind of special, at least in my mind.
Had you wanted to do it for a long time? Had it been sort of in the back of your mind as a project someday?
No, not really. It was just, it was just time to start another book. I was finished with that fourth Roland Ford book, and I needed to get to work on another book. And it came to me kind of swiftly. I realized when I started writing it, however, that the, you know, I've been carrying around really vivid, specific, and sometimes even kind of wild memories of 1968 in Laguna when I first started going there. And I carried those around with me for, you know, 50 years before I, you know, trotted them out into a book. I had no idea at the time when I was 14 that I would be that I was collecting information for a book someday. I had no idea of that. But just the my senses, I think, were really alert, like they are in a lot of young adolescents. My eyes and ears, nose, my smell, I mean, everything. You know, I was just an alive, you know, little guy, and so I kind of just trapped all that stuff in my memory, kind of like a recorder or something maybe. And when I went back to it or revisited it just a couple of years ago, when I started writing A Thousand Steps, it just, the memories just kind of came flooding back. And I didn't realize how much, you know, I had done and remembered of that time.
So then what happened in terms of the story of Matt, the teenager who, has to find his sister. His sister goes missing.
Yeah. You know, before I wrote any of the book, as I was kind of conceiving it and cobbling together a kind of a loose proposal for a publisher, I decided that I wanted to write a coming of age thriller, just in the tiniest of nutshells. I wanted it to be those two things. I wanted it to be about a young boy, an adolescent growing rapidly towards manhood. And I wanted to write a basic kind of whodunit, you know, his sister, no real spoilers here. I mean, his sister has disappeared from the family home in Laguna Beach by the time the first scene even gets going. And so knowing those two things, then it just became a matter of plumbing the mystery for, you know, what has happened to this girl and how Matt, 16-year-old Matt, is going to find her. And, you know, also tracking at the same time Matt's sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle growth during the course of the book. You know, for example, I realized about halfway through the book that I didn't realize ahead of time, but about halfway through the writing, I thought, you know, I think we have to have Matt have a growth spurt now. and he remarks about it, his muscles have been aching for months and stuff. And the doctor tells him it's growing pains and Matt doesn't know. And he goes through a particularly bad bout of knees and elbow, you know, soreness and stuff. And he realizes that it is growing pains and that he's gained all this weight suddenly. And he's much taller than he used to be. So I had to track Matt's, you know, his physical growth and also his transmogrification from a bewildered 16-year-old, you know, boy into an angry, suspicious, capable, and resilient young man. And I kind of captured that in the book. He's a changed character by the end of the book, I think, in subtle ways. And only the whole book only takes place over a couple of, you know, a few weeks. So he's not any really older, but he's grown. And I really had a lot of fun writing the buildings, Ramon, the story of growing. It was really fun to write.
And Laguna Beach too is a character, of course, in the book. And I was curious as I was reading, because I live up the highway from Laguna, mm-hmm. and I was curious what sort of research you had to do in terms of sort of the era and what was in Laguna, and what was happening in Laguna. And Timothy Leary is a part of the book because he was in Laguna at that time. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, this is probably because of the hours and days that I spent there as a youngster, the time I spent there as a youngster, the amount of research that I did into 1968 on this book was really pretty light. I had remembered a great deal of it, I was aware enough, like I was saying at the time, you know, I remember clearly the protests and demonstrations against the Vietnam War, and I remember very clearly the smell of marijuana, you know, permeating Laguna Beach, marijuana smoke. You know, I remember clearly the hippies and their outlandish hair and tie dye this and tie dye that and the bags. They always seem to have so many bags and so I just remember all that stuff, you know, vividly. And so what I did was, I did need to find out what things cost back then, because I'd kind of forgotten what a bottle of shampoo might have cost back then. So I did stuff like that, you know, like gas. I remember from the book now, gas was 39 cents and Matt's a gallon, and Matt's complaining about how much it takes to fill up his mom's hippie van so he can drive around town looking for his sister and stuff. And so things like that, really kind of lightweight research. And I remember Leary being a part of that scene. I never met him until years later, and it wasn't in Laguna, but I was aware of him at the time. I mean, he was sort of a very much a celebrity, you know, and I was aware of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love and the surfers and the drug deals going down everywhere. And so not a lot of research. You know, I got a really cool book called, you know, where is it? Somewhere around here. It's, you know, 1968, and it's all the cultural and advertising and movies and, you know, news stories and everything from that year. And it was just a blast to go through and you know, I cherry picked some of the things you know, in 1,000 steps from that book, but really minimal research. It was more an act of memory than and imagination than digging in and digging up the facts, you know.
How do you merge fact with fiction in terms of, you know, you're writing a novel. Do you feel as a fiction writer that you can embellish what was going on? Or how do you embellish what was going on?
Yeah, I kind of think that's my job, you know, as a novelist, to make maybe clearer and brighter and perhaps more vivid, you know, certain things so that they can be, you know, clearly understood and you know, imagined by the reader. I think that, you know, in this book, there's an underlying kind of an underlying kind of attitude that suggests a tall tale, and by that I mean this book is I exaggerate things in this book and I make I think more intense circumstances and characters in this book than I might normally because I wanted to give it a heightened literally a psychedelic sort of feel. And so there is in this book a celebration, I think, of weirdness and extremity and the time of 1968, which was really truly a weird year. It was a very, very dark and strange year in a lot of ways, as well as being vivid and sort of, you know, crazy in a good way. So anyway, I tried to hit the tone of 68 with the language here and the first person not the first person, but the present tense use, you know, I think is a nice way to kind of shake the reader a little bit and give them something to smile about.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the tense because, you know, I noticed the third person present tense and I was trying to think of other novels of yours that have been written in that way. And I was curious about why you chose the present tense.
I just have come to like it. You know, I read a lot of present tense. It's popular in fiction these days, as you know, and you know, I kind of stubbed my toe on it, you know, 10, 20 years ago when I first seeing it appear, you know, that present tense. So, but over time, I got used to it and I liked it. And I really think that it in this book anyway, that present tense, it provides a wonderful immediacy. And if you're able to string your scenes together with enough velocity, you know, if you can keep your story moving at a good fast speed and present it scene by scene in present tense, you've got a powerful weapon there as a writer. You know, that's literary jujitsu, you know. and I think it works in this book, and it's delightful to write in that present tense. I'm gonna do it again.
Did you have a thought back then in 68 or whenever you would be in Laguna, did you have a thought that someday you'd write about it? Or were you at all a writer back then?
No, not at age 14, I wasn't, Barbara. I was you know, an observer though. You know, I certainly was a curious little guy and curious about the world and people and how things worked. And I like kind of being the fly on the wall, you know, so I had that kind of reporter's writer's maybe, you know, bone structure, but no, I didn't even entertain thoughts of being a writer, even just fantasies of being a writer or imagining what that might be like until I was in high school. I remember in high school, I read a copy of Joseph Heller's Catch 22, and it was forced upon me by my mythology and folklore teacher, Miss Page, because she was angry at our class and she assigned us books out of her garage, old paperbacks. And I got stuck with Catch 22. And it took me forever to read that book because I'm a slow reader. And that book was so much different than anything that I'd read before. I was, you know, say 14, 15. And I was so kind of bowled over by that book. I remember thinking, God, you know, that really would be something to be a writer. And if I remember thinking, if I could give my write a book and get it published and give my readers a millionth of the pleasure and the delight that I got out of Joseph Heller's Catch 22, I would consider myself a lucky man and a successful writer. And so, you know, come college, then I got more serious. And when I got my first job, I started writing my first novel at night and on the weekends and stuff.
And that was Laguna Heat.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. Which I think I've said this to you a couple of months ago. We talked briefly about this, and I said that the first line of 1,000 Steps reminded me so much of the mm-hmm. first line of Laguna Heat. I had to go out to the studio and grab the book. And yeah, was that was the thought? That was your intention?
Yeah, I wanted to echo that first line, that sentence or sentence fragment or whatever it really is. And so it was just an homage to that book a little bit, and a way of sort of a wink to readers like you who would get the inside joke, sort of, you know. But yeah, I definitely wanted that line to echo Laguna Heat. Mm.
Well, I'd love to hear you read from 1,000 Steps.
Okay, well, I can do that.
All right.
I've got 3.5 pages here, which is, I don't know, 5 minutes to read, maybe.
It's great.
And it's just the beginning. It's the first chapter, Barbara. So there's no real spoilers or anything like that. And, you know, the reader won't have to, or the listener won't have to, you know, scratch his head about who's who, because it's all brand new. Okay. So anyway, here it is. 1,000 Steps, Chapter 1, Laguna Beach, June 1968. New morning on a waking city and a heaving dark sea. And on a boy, Matt Anthony, pedaling his bicycle up Pacific Coast Highway. His fishing rod strapped to the rack behind him whips and wobbles in the air. A tackle box rattles and bounces beside it. He's pedaling hard for Thalia Street, where the cop cars and fire engine and an ambulance are clustered, lights flashing. He skids to a stop on the sidewalk and props his bike against the wall of the corner surf shop, hustles past the vehicles to the stairs leading down to the beach, jams his hands into his poncho against the chill, and joins the T Street surf boys who have gathered to watch the cops. Matt recognizes two of the surfers as just graduated seniors from his high school, cool guys, friends of his sister, but they ignore him, wetsuits slung over their shoulders and boards at their sides, all their attention on the dark beach below. Their waves break almost invisibly with overlapping echoes that end abruptly, then repeat. It's hard for Matt to see what's going on down there, but he's a curious 16-year-old, so he clambers down the stairs to the beach, his rock-worn sneakers slapping on the concrete, then thudding in the sand. He gets up close, where he sees, through a knot of Laguna Beach cops standing in a loose circle, a pale girl lying face up on a slab of rock. Her arms are spread and her hair is laced with seaweed. A black bomber-style jacket covers her middle. Matt's ears roar, as they do when he sees something that causes strong emotion. It's like rushing water. A young officer jogs past him, his holster and duty belt clanking, and a blanket tucked under one arm. One of the other cops yanks the blanket from him and spreads it over the girl. Then he looks at Matt. He's Bill Furlong, the big LBPD sergeant who badgers and busts the hippies in town, cuffing and hurting them, sometimes 6 or 8 at a time, into a windowless white prisoner van the locals call Moby Cop. The ambulance team trudges across the beach with a stretcher, pausing for Furlong, who advances on Matt with all his large authority. He's got straight dark hair, heavy brows, and tan eyes. There is something bear-like about him. "Matt," says Furlong, "is that who I think it is?" "That's Bonnie Stratmeyer," says Matt. He feels as if the blood has drained from his face. "How long have you been here?" "Since just now." "How'd the fishing go?" 2 bass. Furlong almost always asks about the fishing and about Matt's mother, brother, and sister. Less so about Matt's father, Bruce, a former cop himself. Now Matt hears the waves slapping and watches the ambulance guys lift Bonnie Stratmeyer onto the stretcher. Facing each other, they rise together, balancing their load. Another wave pops sharply and the blanket slides off. Matt sees Bonnie's yellow bikini and her hair spilling over the stretcher like a drowned animal. Two uniforms put the blanket back over her, then lay the black bomber jacket on top to keep it down. The roar in Matt's head is back. "She's been missing almost 2 months," said Furlong. "Did you know that?" "Everybody knows that," Matt says. He has seen the posters in the shop windows, read a story about her and other runaways in the News Post. He's never talked to her, and now he realizes with a strange recoil that he never will. Bonnie was a brainy one, like his sister, honor roll students. "Is Bonnie the type who would go out swimming in the dark alone?" Furlong asks. I don't know. She's 2 years older than me. Was she in crowd or more to herself? Herself. Was she ahead? I don't know. But do you suspect she used drugs? I don't know, sir. Matt, I want you to look behind you up at the landing where the surfers are standing and tell me, do you think if you jump from there, it would kill you? Matt turns and considers. If you hit a big rock, I think it could. Well, just yesterday, a hippie chick tripping on LSD thought she could jump from the Elmar Motel balcony, fly all the way across Coast Highway, and land on the sidewalk. She's in the hospital right now with more broken bones than you can count. Matt doesn't know what to say. He purses his lips and nods. You still delivering the papers, Matt? Every day. How's your brother doing over in the jungle? He's still there. Say hello to your mom, Matt. Matt nods. Years ago, divorced Furlong tried to date his mom, but Julie Anthony would have none of him. Matt thought it was uncool to treat his mom like a potential girlfriend, any mom. Furlong wears a wedding ring now. Matt has never liked or trusted the man and senses the sergeant knows this. I saw Julie out in Dodge City yesterday, says Furlong. Dodge City being a nickname for a few narrow streets in Laguna Canyon where the rents are low and the hippies and artists and surfers and young freaks have taken root. The houses are mostly small and rickety, clustered amid the eucalyptus trees. At school, Matt hears tales of drugs being smuggled in and out and of cops and FBI staging stings and raids, making arrests, shooting at smugglers running into the canyon brush. He heard there's a monkey chained to a tree, dogs running wild and children running naked. The newspapers he delivers have Dodge City stories all the time with headlines such as Laguna Beach police raid Dodge City, pot, hashish recovered. So naturally, Matt wonders what his mom was doing out there. Mm. That's the end of chapter one.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from A Thousand Steps, published by Forge. Was that pretty much the structure of the first chapter as you began, or do you go back and futz a bunch with the beginning?
Yeah, I fuss with the beginning every day because it's the first thing I see. You know, I get up and pour my coffee and go out and see what I start at the beginning. You know, I see what's there just to get the feel back. And so I went over that a million times. And but I will say that, you know, before I write that first sentence or that the first chapter, I do have a pretty good idea in mind about where I'm gonna go with it, you know, what I'm trying to do. So the essence of that chapter didn't change any, but some of the details and some of the verbiage went, you know, it's interesting you should ask, but you know, this was not only the fastest book I ever wrote. I wrote it in about 6 months. And but it was the longest by far. It was 750 manuscript pages. And by the time I trimmed it down working with my editor and turned in the final version, it was, I don't know, 550. So I cut 200 pages out of this thing. And so every chapter got kind of leaner and smaller as I rewrote on this book. I decided to err when I began the book, to err on the side style and volume and when in doubt, put it in, you know. So I wrote fast and I tried to be as descriptive and as time taking as I wanted to be. So a lot of the book had to be trimmed down to, you know, to fighting weight before it was sent out for the readers.
Do you have a certain word count or page count you need to reach each day or week?
Yeah, I do. It's all just a self-imposed sort of a accounting system that I have. But for me, I work 5 days a week when I can, and long days. And my goal is 5 pages per day. And so that's 25 pages at the end of the week, which is 100 pages in a month. And which if it's a 500, you know, page manuscript or six, say it's a 5 or 6 month project. Of course, it always takes longer than that because I don't get 5 pages a day. I'm very happy with 4, but I feel a little bit miffed when I only get 3. And then I feel, you know, like I've been defeated if I only get 2. And then, you know, some days, you know, I'll come out to work and read over the last five pages that I wrote the day before, and I'll have to delete them all. So you're like, you go into negative numbers at some point, you know? And so all of that is just this kind of goofy, you know, loopy accounting system for keeping me on deadline and making the book not, you know, stretch into infinity, you know, because, you know, novels, they'll try to pull that on you sometimes, you know, they want you to take your time and be deep about things. And sometimes you just got to move it along.
I wanted to ask you about character names, because Matt, you have a brother named Matt. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that Officer Darnell, I thought of our late friend, Peggy Darnell. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering about names, like, how do you come up with names and why was Matt and all that?
Yeah, good question. I wanted to name Matt Anthony in the book after my brother Matt, because I like the name Matt. And Matt Anthony and Matt Parker are both artists. Matt Anthony, young Matt, is the beginning artist. He carries a sketchbook and he tries to mimic the old masters. And my brother Matt is a successful, really good artist on his own as a painter and as a sculptor. So anyway, I named Matt after Matt as a nod to my brother, whom I love dearly and is a great artist. And you know, the rest of people in the book, I always try to pick a name that somehow is either descriptive or surprising, you know, casting with type or against type. And a lot of the characters in this book are named after my old friends and still friends, neighbors, friends, relatives, people I knew in Laguna and Tustin when I was growing up and later. And I just like, this book is littered with little inside jokes like that, so that when Jim Sloan reads the book, he's my best friend from, you know, the time we were 5 years old together. When he reads the book, he'll smile when he sees his parents mentioned by name and you know, stuff like that. It's a way to make characters kind of more believable to me too, you know, because I know exactly what Max and Mill Sloan look like and talk like and everything, you know, from decades ago. And when I name the characters that, then it gives me something to work with. Kind of helpful.
What about sibling stories? Because I think you've written brother stories before, more than once. And this has three siblings, two brothers and one sister. I saw this one as more a brother-sister story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is. I've written a lot of brother stories and a lot of father-son stories. I mean, practically every book I've written has either or both of those things in it. And I can't seem to get it out of my system. There's no better, you know, subject matter that I can think of than a boy and a girl, a brother and a sister, you know, a father and a son. I mean, that's stuff that, you know, that's meaningful stuff, and everybody can kind of relate, I think. So I'm working on another one now, and I'm sure that there'll be there's a good daughter father relationship in it.
Mm. And you know, I was also curious that, you know, Roland Ford, I don't know if you plan to revisit him or do another series character, but I was curious if it becomes, I don't know, tiring or redundant to write a series character, and making a standalone thriller is perhaps more compelling because it's a new character, it's a new situation, it's going to begin and end in this book. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you've written various series characters, and what do you think? I mean, do you like one or the other better?
You know, oddly enough, I think that writing a series is in general, for me, more difficult than writing standalone books. And I also think that writing a series can be, isn't always, but can be less enjoyable than writing standalone novels for the reasons that you just gave. You know, I love coming to a novel with the proverbial 500 blank pages. You know, I love those white pages with nothing on them. And I love the idea that I'm going to get to finish the story within those pages. And I'm not, because I'm not writing a series, and because this isn't, you know, a sequel of any kind, I don't know who the characters are or where they live or what they've done or what their background. I have nothing to go on except what interests me, you know, and what boils in my imagination as I sit down and stare at those pages. So, you know, it's a very different deal. I have to say that I think writing the series is very difficult, and I have immense amount of respect for the guys who write a thriller a year or a mystery a year, sometimes even two, and can keep a series going for 10, 15 books. That's the longest I've ever written a series is six. And by the time I wrote that sixth book of Charlie Hood series, and by the time I wrote the fourth book of the Roland Ford series, I was ready for a change, you know? And that's one of the reasons why A Thousand Steps just literally butted into the Roland Ford series and took over my life. It, you know, A Thousand Steps said, no, you're writing me. You're not writing that. So, and it was fun. I was a willing victim.
So when you were finished with A Thousand Steps and these characters, did you have any thought of, well, maybe I could bring them back and, you know, go into the future? What are they doing now? I mean, does that occur to you, or going into this, did you go, you know what, this is going to be one book, characters will be in this book, and then that will be it?
Yeah, well, that's what I decided finally, Barbara. But my first instinct upon finishing this and then starting to cast my net for another story, I thought, well, God, this one was so much fun to write and stuff, and it was so bright, and I like this present tense stuff, and I love Matt and everything. Why don't I just pick him up a couple of years later or 5 years later, and he can still be in Laguna doing something? Maybe he's an artist, or, you know, I don't know. And the more I thought about it, I thought, nah, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that to A Thousand Steps. I want this thing to stand alone, literally, and I don't want any attempts at you know, to grow it into something more than one novel. I don't want that. I don't want it. I don't feel like it would be a good use of time. And I don't think that this book needs anything more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the hardest part? Is the beginning, middle, or end? Is one of those harder for you? Or, I don't know, what was the hardest part of writing A Thousand Steps?
Well, I love beginnings for the reasons of freedom and liberty that you have. It's like you know the jet has just taken off, you know, and you're going to a foreign land, and I love that. You know, middles are tough because you need to keep and maintain the velocity that your beginning has had and promises, and you need to complicate and deepen the story at the same time. And there's a point in most novels, I think, that especially novels that are mystery thriller type, that where you're done creating problems and you're done making promises, and it's time now to deliver the second half of the book based on what the first half has promised. And so those middles can be tough, but still the ends are the ones that make me lose sleep. I lose sleep over the endings pretty much every novel. And it usually comes, I'm usually like, say, 400 pages into the novel, and it's going to be a 550 page book, say. And so I'm staring down the barrel of the last 100 plus pages, maybe 200. And I know, and I have all these complications and things in the air and unanswered questions. And you know, thrillers and mysteries novels are complicated. They often are, not always, but often very complicated. And so I just wake up at night thinking, well, God, how am I going to handle all these, you know, these bad guys and these helicopters, and how's this going to happen? And, you know, how's poor Matt ever going to find his sister when they've got her in this blah, blah, blah. So the endings are tough because they're the hardest, because everything has to be right. Like the ending of this book, I won't say what it is or anything, but that there is one big sort of action scene that climaxes the story. It's near the end, and that was probably one of the hardest scenes that I ever have written, because it was all action, and there's a bunch of characters doing a bunch of things, and it plays on the page kind of like a really busy, crowded movie with a whole bunch of stuff going on at once, you know. And that kind of action writing is surprisingly hard to do.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Well, you know what I mean from your writing. I mean, you know how in noir writing and in tightly plotted, writing that involves often, scenes that involve violence, it has to be perfect. If it's not perfect, it's just going to fall apart. And so the writing action and any kind of violence or just action is difficult. There's a fishing scene in A Thousand Steps that I spent immense amount of time on to get right, and I know how to fish, and still it's a big action scene, and you have the ghost of Hemingway looking over your shoulder as you write a fishing scene and all that kind of jazz. And again, fishing is an action, and action is just hard to write about. It's much easier to write dialogue. You can write people talking to each other all day, but try making a believable scene about a person in a gunfight, and it's a whole nother deal.
Yeah, and speaking of well, dialogue, but scene versus narrative, you always seem to have such a nice balance between the two, where it's like not overloaded with narrative, not overloaded with dialogue and scene. And at this point, I mean, after 27 books and many short stories and essays and everything else, I mean, was it always did that always come easy to you, or was there something you learned? Was there a teacher or someone that or maybe in your reading that you just got it?
That's an interesting question. I know what you're talking about in the kind of balance, if you will, or the rhythm between dialogue and narration, and I, a piece of writing has its own kind of rhythm. Literally, rhythm, it's a beat, and it's in the language and in the stops and in the interplay of dialogue and scene setting and description, I know as a reader, when I would read books that were, all dialogue, I felt that my inner it wasn't right. It didn't feel right to me. And conversely, when I would read, long, 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 long narratives with no dialogue at all, no real scenes, just real, dense, long writing, gigantic paragraph after chapter after chapter, I felt that there was some rhythmic loss there too, So, my natural, ear as a writer says that kind of contrapuntal rhythm between the dialogue and the description is valuable, and it lends refreshment, and it carburetes a book in a really good way. There's always air and play and motion in there in that situation. So that's what I try for.
Yeah, and I was looking at Laguna Heat, your first book, and looking at A Thousand Steps, and you always seem to have how it looks on the page as well. There's enough white space so that the reader doesn't see just long blocks of paragraphs, long blocks of text, but that there's some relief to the eye. It's interesting. Well, anyway, we are getting to the end of our time, and I wonder if there's anything that I don't know, that has stayed with you over the years of writing all these books that maybe you wish you had known sooner.
Known sooner. Gosh, gosh.
I mean, writers just sort of, I don't know, I've heard so many writers say, if only I had known that, 10 years ago, whatever, about writing.
I don't have one of those really that I can think of. I do think though that as a young writer, I was blessed by a long list of things that I didn't know about writing and the business of writing and the writing of writing. I was young, and what I did have though is I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the act of it, not all the time, but mostly I enjoyed it. And I had ferocious amounts of ambition and energy that I could put towards the idea of trying to write something that would be worthy of being published someday. So you know, all my ignorance really helped me, I think. You know, I thought when, you know, Laguna Heat was done and had its run and stuff, that, you know, every time I wrote a book, there would be an HBO movie made about it, and it would be on the LA Times bestseller list for a month and stuff, you know. And if I'd known back then that it doesn't always happen that way, I think life would have been less fun, you know. I was too dumb to know any better, and it was a blessing.
Well, I like that. Things you're glad you didn't know.
Yeah.
Jeff, thank you so much for coming back on the show. And best of luck with 1,000 Steps.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's a real pleasure to be on your show, and I'll come anytime you call.
Thanks. That was T. Jefferson Parker, author of 1,000 Steps, published by Forge. The show was produced by Barbara DeMarco Barrett, music and sound editing by Travis Barrett. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. More at penonfire.com.